Deezer Originals.
This is Defending in Numbers.
Oh, thank God, the international break is over till March. This is Defending in Numbers, the podcast where we walk down the corridor of uncertainty, pretending to know a little bit more about football than we actually do. I, of course, am Rob Armstrong, a pretender, someone who judges football on emotion and pretty much what I'm told. And here to tell me stuff about football today, of course, it's Hot Take Jake the Snake Entwistle. Jake, how are you?
Yeah, I'm great. I'm going to be telling you all the things about football today that you could ever want to hear.
George, you're the other guest today. George Ellick, that was your big introduction. What are you going to tell me about football, specifically last night in Oxford?
Well, it's going to be difficult if Jake's telling you everything there is to know. But yeah, I was at Oxford last night, who were 3-0 down within about 15 minutes at home. Good way to spend your Tuesday missing the Champions League football. But I have seen it. I've caught up overnight, so I'm well prepared.
And I'll tell you a great way you could have passed the journey home. You could have gotten to Deezer, iTunes, subscribed to Defending in Numbers, rated it, shared it, subscribed, left a review, all those things.
I've done all before.
Oh, of course you have. Of course you have.
I haven't reviewed it. That would be a bit weird.
Because you're a Deezer geezer.
Yeah, indeed.
You haven't reviewed it.
Can't review your own show.
Oh, all the positive reviews are me. I've got so many iTunes
Don't
accounts.
Say that, I mean. Yeah, I was going to say, cut that out.
Cut that out as we walk straight into Week by Numbers.
The Week by Numbers.
First up, we're going to make Jake's day with the number 10.35, and that's the number of kilometres covered by Mesut Ozil versus Spurs. The overrated flop Mesut Ozil. The lazy Mesut Ozil. Man of the match against Spurs. And to be honest, it looked like pretty easy work for Arsenal, didn't it, Jake?
It was, to be fair, I had a smile across my face the whole game. More because...
Shock.
It was more the fact that because he ran that distance, he's now appeased everyone that doubted him, and now people realise sort of how useful he can be. Because, to be honest, the best thing about that game was, again, his creativeness. The front three finally again playing together, Sanchez, Lacazette and Ozil. When they played together, Arsenal have looked better and looked like a great attacking side. And that game against Spurs ended our six-game winless run against the North London rivals. So it was a massive win for Arsenal, and it was more of sort of a statement of intent. You would hope, as an Arsenal fan and from the club's point of view going forward, that they managed to win 2-0. Now they're up against Burnley next week.
Yeah, I was going to say level on points with the massive Burnley, aren't you?
So we're punching above our weight, it seems, up there with Sean Dyche's side. But yeah, it was just that game by Mesut Ozil was really good to see, because with all the doubt about his future, you're just thinking, oh, is he going to put in one of these performances again where everyone will easily blame him for Arsenal's 4-0 defeat to Spurs, when it actually went the other way. He created four chances. He's now joint leader of chance creation in the Premier League, most from open play, racking up another assist, and it was great to see him back to his best, and hopefully that will continue for the rest of the season.
And of course, George, he's an explosive gif as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think that's probably his biggest impact, even after his best performance in about a year. But I think that, you know, you said the word lazy. I think that the people who call Ozil lazy are the lazy ones, basically. And the people who are going to look at this stat today and see that as being a sign that he's back are probably quite lazy as well. Ozil's always been a player who, you know, on the pitch when things aren't going well, is never going to look like your most active. But I think, you know, he's always worked pretty hard. He's someone who I don't think is never going to grab a game by the scruff of the neck. But I think when Arsenal perform like they did on Saturday, and the players like Ramsey and Xhaka are giving him a platform on which to play, he's always going to be that good. So it doesn't surprise me to see this stat. I think that it'll go in another circle if he does stay long enough at Arsenal, that he'll be criticised again when Arsenal's chips are down again. But he's a fantastic footballer and a massive asset to that club, and hopefully matches like that on Saturday will help persuade the fan base and the management to continue to keep the faith.
Is it a turning point? Because Arsenal seem to have this every season. They get through, they sort of stumble through one horrible month, have three great months, have another horrible month.
I think because of the fan pressure on Wenger, bad situations at Arsenal are massively exacerbated. I don't think there was ever a stage this season. I don't think there can really be a stage unless, you know, you do a proper Chelsea from a couple of years ago. When you're in November, mid-November, early November, where you're in crisis, because it's just a couple of defeats, which doesn't take long to get back into it. You know, whilst Arsenal may be level on points with Burnley, they're 2 points behind Spurs. This is a Spurs team who 3 weeks ago we were saying were the only people who could challenge City for the title. A couple of bad results from City, and suddenly everyone's going to be closing the pack with them. So I think that whilst it's unlikely this is going to be the trigger for Arsenal season to, to really push forward towards the top end, I do think there was another reaction in the first place, and they're still well set for a top four finish.
Arsenal going to win the league, Jake?
Yeah, well, we're on our current, our best ever winning streak at the Emirates Stadium in the Premier League with 11 games. So, as George has said, these bad situations, the games that we've played and won are ones that you'd expect to win. But that's something, again, with Arsenal you associate with, yeah, they might turn up for one big game. Usually Man City away was quite a big game that we did well in. Also against Chelsea recently. But we've beaten these teams at home, and Arsenal now, you'd hope, have got that platform. And as George said, it's funny how it takes this numbers of kilometres covered by Mesut Ozil for him to be appreciated.
But he's run 10.35 kilometres for people's approval.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. You know, running stats are fairly misleading anyway, because it can tell you a lot more about the game itself. I think the fact that Spurs are such a high-intensity team, even though they didn't turn up particularly on Saturday, I mean, the style of play was still the same. It was still a high press. They were still trying to shut down every ball, and that's inevitably going to lead to it. It was a very frantic game. I mean, I don't know the exact stat, but the pass completed in the game is much, much lower than you expect from either team because it's a derby, and that in itself is going to lend itself probably to a more energetic performance. So, whilst Ozil was rightly man of the match and the standout player on the pitch, I think that 10.35 is probably the one stat that is fairly innocuous in him getting there.
Well, let's talk about ground covered and energetic performances, because Zlatan Ibrahimovic came back this weekend and immediately stood straight up front and told Romelu Lukaku to go out to right wing so he could stand there and basically get the ball pinged at him. But the number is 216, and that's the number of days between the Zlatan's last two Premier League games. Obviously, that... Is it ACL injury?
Yeah.
Same as me. So I ruptured my ACL 2 weeks after Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He's just returned. I haven't even had surgery yet. So I'm clearly not a lion. Basically, all those players coming back from Man United, and straight away, they turn it back on. Pogba, huge, huge, huge impact. Lukaku on a bit of a scoring drought. Obviously, that's ended now, but now they've got that second option. And they're going to start going to how we thought they were at the beginning of the season, where we said these two, Man City and Man United, are a step above everyone else. Is that going to be the case again now they've got their players back?
I think the Pogba returning is the massive thing. As you just said, when he came back, they finally had someone in midfield that they've been relying on Nemanja Matic to sort of do his screening job, but then also bring it forward. Now with Pogba, he's got his partner back, where Matic can do all the clean everything up, give it to him, and then you've got Pogba playing every pass and trying to make things happen. Just for Ibrahimovic, I think he's played this absolutely perfectly from sort of his sort of PR viewpoint, because he's come back and immediately said, oh, by the way, my knee injury was much better than anyone else knew, much worse, sorry, than anyone else knew. So he's sort of like, not only have I come back in 7 months, I've also done it when I probably should have been out a year. And his first shot on target, or his first shot, was
a scissor kick.
It's quite Trumpian. Like, my knee injury is the best knee injury ever.
Yeah.
It's that similar mentality of like ensuring that people understand that, you know, it's all about him, even off the pitch.
A year out, sad.
Yeah.
Wrong. 7 months.
216 days, actually. But I do think that you have to exercise caution here again, because United have had absolutely no trouble dispatching the worst teams in the league all season. We saw that with West Ham early on. We saw it at Swansea. And that four goal, seems to be a staple of theirs when they're taking on worst teams. And I think that Pogba...
But Newcastle aren't that bad, are they? Newcastle have done all right.
Newcastle aren't that bad.
That's my glowing report.
Fine. You know, I mean, I do agree with you, but at the same
Swansea
time...
Swansea and West Ham are...
Yeah, fine.
Crap.
Yeah, I agree. But I think in a weird way, I mean, this is another conversation, but I think that Newcastle taking the lead didn't help them at all in that respect, because it just meant that it just invited United onto them and created a basically clinical siege of talent in effect, and it meant they sat back further, which probably makes them a worse team in itself. But I would say that Pogba will help, but there's still got to be question marks over Pogba's output in these big games. It's been said time and time again that Lukaku is totally unproven in big games as well. So whilst you can't argue that it's going to benefit them, I do think that Pogba's stature for Manchester United and in the Premier League has grown whilst being injured. And he's now got to actually do it on the pitch to prove that he is the missing piece of the jigsaw. And that performance in Newcastle, whilst great, it isn't quite enough yet for me.
I think for Man United, to be sort of the antagonist to that, I think the games that they'd won 4-0 previously, they'd actually gone 1-0 up, and then they'd been incredible counter-attacking team. Like, they'd have Martial on the pitch, that would wear someone out and it would be 1-0 and then they'd bring Rashford or vice versa, and that's when they won 4-0. So the fact that when last season they could not break down a team, even if they'd gone, especially if they'd gone 1-0 behind, I thought the Newcastle game, when it was 1-0, in my head I was thinking, I know they're probably going to get something, but it'll be a last minute Zlatan header and we'll have this monologue about the Lion returning. But the fact that they won 4-1 almost surprised me. And again, it's mainly through, as George said, like a siege of crossing the ball. They've actually crossed the ball more times in the Premier League this season than any other team. So there's a clear sort of tactic with Ashley Young coming back in the team that they want to use that aerial dominance that they have. When Fellaini comes back, Jose Mourinho towards the end of games could have Ibrahimovic, Lukaku and Fellaini all in the box. Like that's made
Martial
for...
Martial and Rashford were great. Look, well, Rashford's header for the third goal was brilliant, wasn't it? And then Martial's header. Who expected Martial to bang in a header was it the top corner? But whatever,
no, he climbed massively for that. And that was his first goal he scored when he started a game in the Premier League. So I think there were good signs from that game. George is right. We can't, again, just all of a sudden say, Pogba's back, now Man United will win the league again.
Pogba.
But exactly, we can't get carried away by the hashtag.
Pog caution.
Yeah, Pog caution is probably the best one to go forward with. But I think Paul Pogba is a big difference maker. He will eventually make the difference in those big games. And just everything goes through him. He's top of nearly every metric for Man United since he joined the club. And I just think funneling the ball through him is their best option, not necessarily relying on Ashley Young's brilliant crossing ability.
So definitely towards Pog back than Pog bollocks, I reckon.
All right, let's take the Pog bollocks to Spain, where we're going to talk about Valencia and the number 30. So they've got 30 points after just 12 games so far this season. Valencia, we've had, let's face it, a pretty turbulent kind of 10 years, more or less.
Worse than that.
Constantly in sort of financial disarray. I can't really remember them being consistently good since the David Villa days and maybe the Rafa Benitez days.
David Villa, David Silva and Juan Mata.
The dream. Nice,
they were churning out some talent.
And aging Pablo Aimar as well, just pulling the strings.
And somehow it all went kind of wrong. But this season, they're back. Led by Simone Zaza, of all people. Simone Zaza, who is outscoring Cristiano Ronaldo in the league. Well, the whole of the BBC, pretty much Real Madrid aren't scoring too many, are they? But Simone Zaza is outscoring Ronaldo. Last year, I saw Simone Zaza struggle, and I mean really struggle, against Accrington Stanley. And now he's outscoring Ronaldo 12 games into La Liga season.
I remember Chelsea Macclesfield, I think it was, and Mo Salah was comfortably the worst player on the pitch with both teams in the FA Cup, and now look at him. I think that Valencia is exciting because it's representing, in an age now where basically these smaller European clubs, not that Valencia is a small club, but clubs who are overachieving in Europe, I think generally follow quite a similar recruitment strategy where it's basically young players that they are extensive scouting networks are locating and then selling it on for profit. Whereas Valencia is a bit of a kind of a stopping off point for people who have been misfits at bigger clubs. If you look at Zaza, as you mentioned, maybe West Ham aren't a bigger club, but his career has been similar. Gabriel as well, from Arsenal's there as well. I think it's interesting to see. And then they've got class stats like Parejo as well. I mean, I think that, as you mentioned, it's a club who's underachieving, but I think they're showing there's value to be found at those players who have been invested in by clubs with good strategies and good recruitment systems who fail to settle in, and then they can basically go and pick them up on the cheap and then try and tap into whatever it was that they initially found and liked.
And I think Marcelino, the manager, deserves credit for that. They've got them playing like a really exciting brand of football. They've scored 32 goals in La Liga this season, which is only one fewer.
With Simone Zaza
exactly.
on the pitch.
Simone Zaza and Rodrigo up front are really good. They play...
Kondogbia is another one as well.
16 between them, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Mm. It's quite remarkable. They're one of the... So Benzema and Ronaldo are famously recently the worst duo in Europe. Zaza and Rodrigo are up there with some of the best. And they play this really good counter-attacking style. They've scored the most goals on the fast break in La Liga this season. And they only average 48.6% possession, which shows that it's a really exciting brand of football in the fact that when they get the ball, you know they're going to go forward and try and do something with it. Scoring 32 goals with less than 50% possession is impressive. And as George was saying, getting these sort of misfits, one player that I think is catching everyone's attention the most that isn't their own, they've got Carlos Soler, who's a very good youngster that's come up through Valencia, and Santi Mina as well. But Gonzalo Guedes, who is on loan from PSG, he was a misfit in the fact that PSG bought him for a lot of money from Portugal. He didn't really play any games. He's gone to Valencia now, and now he looks, again, he's the one that everyone's, he's getting all the fans off their seat, and he's the one driving these counterattacks with his pace and dribbling. So I think they play a really exciting football. They're obviously still unbeaten. Barcelona are still unbeaten, and they meet at the weekend. So this will be the biggest test, because Barcelona, for all their for all that went wrong in the summer, have only conceded 4 goals and they're top of the league easily. So if Valencia can do something against them, then they cut the gap to 1 point and open it up for Real Madrid again. But it'll be really good to see Valencia fight all the way. But you just think, no matter how well they've started, they're going to eventually fall to the...
You have to worry. It's like Valencia will probably become Valencia again halfway through the season, won't they? They'll get to January and they'll sell everyone that's playing well and replace the manager with Gary Neville.
I think Valencia would take becoming Valencia again if it means that they're the fourth biggest team in Spain, though. And that's probably the aim at the moment.
Europe, isn't it? Yeah. Talking of Ronaldo and that, they scored 6 on Tuesday night. Is that going to be a little bit of a turning point for them, maybe? Because that is a club whose season needs to kind of kick on a little bit.
I don't think a 6-0 against Apoel is going to necessarily get them back into confidence, but Ronaldo broke the record for most Champions League goals in a calendar year, scoring 2. He's got 18. He's got 1, 2 and 3 on that list. He scored 8 goals in the Champions League this season and 1 in La Liga. His form in La Liga is documented, and 1 goal from 55 shots is obviously very poor, but I don't think he's poor. And Real Madrid, if you look at the expected goals figures for Real Madrid, they actually should have scored more than Barcelona according to some models, and they've got 11 less. So Real Madrid themselves have, again, you could argue that Zidane's tactics sometimes have been a bit just one-dimensional. Again, they cross the ball a lot. They're actually the biggest crossers in the whole of Europe's top 5
David
leagues.
Moyes will go there next though.
Exactly. they should have got him in, really, to help out. But I think Real Madrid, the fact that they are, again, I know they lost to Spurs and they didn't play well in either game, really, but I think they'll be back in La Liga. And as we said, Valencia have come out of the blocks really fast, but it's 12 games in. Real Madrid will be up there by the end, and Ronaldo will definitely be in the goals, I think.
Also going to pick up Ronaldo on a free in January?
Wouldn't take him.
No. One goal in the league.
Exactly. He shoots too much. I think, talking about Apoel, I think if I was a manager of a Spanish club watching that game, I think I would pretty quickly realise that you don't really want to leave too much space in behind against Madrid. I think it's just telling everyone probably just to sit back a bit and probably just try and stifle them rather than basically laudably going quite attacking, because that's what led to Apoel's undoing, really.
All right, let's talk about England's Apoel, and that's West Brom. We obviously had to say goodbye to their dearly beloved Tony Pulis, one of the most popular managers in the Premier League this season. West Brom fans hate Tony Pulis, and that's probably because the next number is 105, and that's the number of Premier League goals West Brom scored under Tony Pulis in 106 games, less than a goal a game.
Who do you think was happier about this, West Brom fans or Pulis himself, about the news?
He seemed, when he gave his interview at the end of the game, he seemed like he was kind of asking to be let go, didn't he? He was giving a speech without having been sacked, basically saying, well, you know, the owners are good people and they'll probably make the right choice. I'm sure I'm probably gone and it's a good decision from them. It's like he was begging for it.
Well, he's never been relegated, has he? So he probably thought, oh, my one defining feature's under threat.
That whole no been relegated thing is just so stupid. Because basically, if your manager's been relegated, the chances are you've probably taken over once the damage has been done. So and Big Tone's managed to get out and leave this relegation up to someone else.
But what about Tony Pulis? Because everyone said, everyone's made the same joke about, oh, well, the West Brom owners have sacked Tony Pulis and next they'll be looking for Tony Pulis. What are they going to look for next? I mean, Big Sam's been knocking about with Everton and flirting with the States job, but I don't think he'd go to...
I don't know. Probably. I think, they got new owners in at West Brom about 18 months ago. I think are much more ambitious than maybe the Pulis. I mean, Pulis was already there when they came in. I think that it wouldn't surprise me to see them go fairly ambitious, to look quite left field. I know there's been talk about McInnes, who's actually done a fantastic job at Aberdeen, so that could be interesting. But I do think that in terms of budget, the current squad isn't quite there, but it's not that dissimilar to Everton.
I think they're missing maybe a striker like Rondon's not being fired.
But it's more, you haven't got many fullbacks. You've got a lot of centre backs because it's Pulis ball. I wouldn't be surprised if they went for someone slightly unexpected, rather than a, kind of what you'd think a West Brom appointment would be.
Yeah, I think they should as well. I think, as you said, with the new owners and the way the players, the sort of players they've been buying, it sort of suggests that there's a deeper recruitment plan. It's not as we've spoken about before, the sort of lazy strategy of, oh, who's played in the Premier League? Have they played in there for 5 years? Yeah, let's get them in. The recent signings, like the Krakowiak on loan from PSG, I'm not saying that he's necessarily done well, but that sort of recruitment suggests, again, that there is ambition. They want to attract players that Krakowiak's won the Europa League a few times and was very good at Sevilla. So I think West Brom have the opportunity now to appoint a manager that, as George said, is a bit left field. And although they're in a bad position, I think the platform is there to do something fairly good with that club. And West Brom fans will almost be forgiving if anyone comes in and tries to implement a philosophy, because they've been used to this West Brom Tony Pulis philosophy for so long that they are probably absolutely desperate for change or any sort of attacking intent. So I think there's the manager that comes in will have a bit of a grace period in the fact that they'll be willing and open to something new. And Tony Pulis going sort of fills the vacuum of, let's move away from just getting a relegation specialist in or someone that can win. He won manager of the season, not winning the league, and he's only one of the four managers to do that. Mm. So he's obviously talented at what he does and keeping people up. It was on that Crystal Palace season, but even if West Brom go down, maybe they just need something like that to rebuild and not be clinging on to Premier League status, because that's what drives a sort of boring approach to the game, I think.
There's also been some interesting stuff written. I think Rory Smith wrote something for the New York Times saying that these days, because the top six is so ingrained and because it's fairly unlikely that anyone else is going to break into it, kind of surviving and playing not a very good brand of football isn't going to be enough anymore, because you're going to have to appease the fans in a different way. If you know, seventh place is your top target, then fans are going to expect to be excited by the football they're seeing every week. Whereas lumping it long and not being very easy on the eye and finishing ninth, who's the winner? You know, I think West Brom fans would probably have a more enjoyable season winning the championship than finishing mid-table in the Premier League and playing ugly set PC, nasty football.
Where's Pulis going next? Do you reckon they'll take him at Benevento?
I need him. 13.
That would be absolutely brilliant if you went out there and saved them. Then I'd doff my cap to him.
Pulisinho.
Yeah.
No, Pulis. Well, it was Aladici, wasn't it? What would the Italian Pulis be? Pulisici.
Pulisic, that's someone else.
Yeah, he's Croatian, yeah. Pulisini.
Pulisini, yeah.
There you go.
Antoni Pulisini. Let's move away from my Italian onto the next number, number 9. And now we're talking about Mohamed Salah, who I would say is certainly up there in terms of signings of the season in the Premier League so far. The player that left Chelsea is not the player that has joined Liverpool this year. He is scoring all over the place. Scored on Tuesday night as well in the Champions League against Sevilla. Did he not?
He didn't score on a
Firmino twice.
What? Mane.
Am I imagining things? I clearly am imagining things. But regardless of what happened on Tuesday, forget the Champions League, Salah's useless. He's scored more goals than any other Liverpool player in history after 12 Premier League games. That was Robbie Fowler before, and of course he was God, was he not?
Exactly.
So what does this make Salah? Also God. The second
God mark too, yeah. So scoring 9 in his first 12, he's the top scorer as well. It's not like he's scored 9 and everyone else is banging them in. He's genuinely top of the Premier League goal scoring charts at the moment. And that in itself deserves huge credit. And I personally, when they signed him, I thought I knew he was a good player and I thought he was going to do well, but I didn't realise how many goal scoring opportunities he found himself in. I knew that he had a decent goal-scoring record at Roma, but I wasn't quite sure how he was doing it. And I think the way he works with Firmino is perfect for him. Firmino's the one that's dropping in and sort of, if they channel every... Liverpool seem to channel a lot of their play down the left because that's Coutinho's habitat. He's either playing left wing or the left side of those midfielders. And then that leaves Salah, unless they're countering and he's carrying the ball forward. Salah's ghosting into these back post areas and sort of and getting in the box and getting a lot of shots away. So he's almost playing as the like false... They've got Firmino, who's
false
apparently
eight,
this false...
seven.
Yeah, Firmino's this false nine, and then Salah takes his space, and Salah's had the most shots of any Liverpool player. He's had the most shots on target in the Premier League this season. So for a winger to be getting those positions and not necessarily having a lot of on-the-ball actions. So someone like Alexis Sanchez and Richarlison for Watford, this season they've had a lot of shots because they're that left winger that always demands the ball, cuts inside, shoots. Whereas Salah, for me, is more about the fact he's getting in the box and getting those shooting opportunities. So, yeah, to be breaking records that Robbie Fowler set for Liverpool, he's obviously made a massive impact, and Liverpool fans love him. But signing of the season as well, early stages, you could be leaning towards him, but there are a couple of other candidates, I think.
I mean, you can never trust the first 12 games. No. Because what was that? What was the Amir Zaki? Do you remember him for Wigan?
Yeah.
He'd scored like 11 by now.
What is it,
like,
what
he's
is it
gonna
with,
be incredible.
What is it with Egyptians and fast starts? Start.
Yeah, but George, Salah, because I have watched a few Liverpool games this year, clearly not the one on Tuesday, because I forgot them. I saw the goals as well. I was watching that goal show. It just shows all of them. I don't know why I thought he scored. I can't get over it. Yeah, but I was under the impression from the games where I've watched Liverpool this year that Salah takes like millions of shots before he gets his goals. But then they were saying on that he's got one of the best chance conversion rates or something. Look, you're the stats guy. I don't know.
I think you've just kind of hit the nail on the head there, because I think that classically maybe he's been more wasteful. I mean, he's always scored goals, to be honest, and he did so at Roma for the last couple of seasons since leaving Chelsea. But I think that this is unsustainable, basically. He has never been as clinical as he is being now. This fast start is great, but it's unfair on him and probably unlikely that he will continue scoring at this rate. That's not to say he won't continue to get into goal scoring positions that Jake mentions, but it'll probably revert to the mean again, and he probably will start missing chances. And right wingers generally don't score nearly a goal a game rate for a reason. And yeah, I mean, what a fantastic signing. It looked like a good signing before they got him, and it's proven to be as such so far. But I'd exercise, I seem to be saying this a lot, I'd exercise caution again before getting too excited about Salah.
Caution.
But his 42 shots is a lot of shots to get nine goals. I know he's top scorer, but that conversion rate is 21%. So that's not actually
huge.
It's not like, oh, he's scoring every other shot. Like Falcao at the beginning of the season had scored 13 from 16 shots.
Rashford's first few games United.
Exactly. That's unsustainable. Whereas Salah, if he keeps getting, so 42 shots, as I said, 26 on target, he's getting a lot of chances, and that shows that he's missing some. He has put some straight at the keeper, or he's had smashed some wide. So the current rate he's going at, he'll be on, if he sustained it, which we've said could be, 20% isn't a ridiculous conversion rate, but that means if he stays at this rate, he'll be getting 28.5 goals, so 28 or 29 by the end of the season. I know, he'll be the first ever player to do that as well. There's a stat for you. I can't see him getting 28 goals, but he's definitely going to score more goals because of the way Liverpool play because of that system. As I said, they're using him as that. He comes in and tucks in and becomes a forward, and also can lead one man. Like when him and Sadio Mane break, they've shown already this season that you can't catch them. So
I feel like
playing the Theo Walcott role at the back post.
I feel like with Liverpool, it's quite a nice position they're in attacking wise. Because if one of them goes out of form, if Salah stops getting in those goal scoring positions, Mane probably will.
Mm.
And then if both of them are a bit off, then Coutinho will start shooting from outside the box, which obviously he makes his living by doing. And then if all of those three aren't firing, they've got Firmino as well, who's just kind of a classy. And he scored two on Tuesday. No, he didn't. He scored
one.
Did.
No, he
scored two. Who scored?
You didn't.
From this embarrassing moment where I can't work out who's who in Liverpool's attack, let's move on to the next section, which is conveniently named I'm Embarrassed to Ask, or Try and Remember Who Scored for Liverpool 2 days ago.
I'm Embarrassed to Ask.
Umar Niasse. I'm not the only one who should be embarrassed, because he has gone and got himself the dubious honour of being the first player ever, and I'm going to have to look at the sheet to remember what the actual charge is, to be involved in the successful deception of a match official, as known to the layman as diving. But how is he the first person that's been caught of it? Because you see it three times in every game, and he's been banned for it, whereas if you get caught on the pitch, it's just a yellow card. So it seems a bit odd to me that they'll charge it. And then when you look back at it, he is running at full pace, and don't get me wrong, there's not a lot of contact, but there is some contact. How have they managed to come to the decision where they're going to ban him for two games, when if you do an outright blatant dive and get caught on the pitch, it's a yellow card?
So, I think the key distinction is that they profited from his dive. They got a penalty from it. And that, you know, if you dive and you don't win the penalty, then you're not profiting from it. You get a yellow card. So, you're almost being punished for succeeding in your deception. But I do agree with you that in this case, I think it's harsh. I don't think that you could say with 100% certainty, having watched the replays back, that Nias is simulating contact in order to try and deceive the referee. People out there who seem to think that there is no distinction between it's either a dive or it's a foul, that's not the case. There can be contact and it cannot be a foul. Someone can go over and wave their hands around, it cannot be a dive. Whilst I think that it looked very, very soft, if anything, I do still think that for the first person to get suspended for it, it should have been a more clear-cut one. Mm. So I think this is now going to open a can of worms.
What's the panel as well that decides it? Do we know?
I think it just gets to one of those secret refereeing boards where...
So no ex-pros?
So I don't think so. I think it's...
They've never played the game.
I think it's more officials. So they don't... Yeah, they don't know the game, but...
They're not...
Well, that's what everyone says, isn't it?
You've never played.
You've never dived.
Just students of the game who literally had to take exams in order to be able to officiate on it.
Well, Jake, so you're a quick person. I've never run quick, so I wouldn't know, but you're quite a quick person. I've seen you... I mean, when you're playing football, you mostly shout, but I've also seen you run at some points, and you go quite fast.
Shouting and running.
If someone touches you a little bit when you're sprinting, right, I think you do go down quite easily. I think people sometimes forget about that when they see the Premier League. They forget how fast these players are running and like what supreme athletes they are. And if you go to Usain Bolt and you put a fingertip on his thigh when he's running at full pelt, like, even though your fingertip's probably going to come flying off and go 30 yards the other way, like, you're going to put him off his sprint, right? And these are, don't get me wrong, they're not running at Usain Bolt pace, but they're running pretty fast. So how can it be that if there's any contact at all, that some board of referees that never played the game can decide that that's worthy of a ban?
Yes. I think the best player to look out for this, and he's recently come under fire from Arsene Wenger, was Raheem Sterling. Raheem Sterling, I feel so sorry for, because the amount of decisions that don't go his way and then do go his way, or he gets punished for, as you said, he's a little twinkle toe winner. He's very quick and quick off the ball. And when you shift the ball and someone pushes you, it is sometimes hard to keep your balance. And I don't think Raheem Sterling's the sort of player that when he goes down, he throws his hands in the air. They can look soft, but as you said, you've made a point bang on there. When you're running so quick, or when you're shifting your body one way after doing a step over or quickly changing direction, you're not at your best balance at that point. So even if you get a slight touch, you can't. It would be harsh to sometimes then say, "Oh, you've dived. You've played for that. You've simulated the contact." Sometimes you can't stay on your feet, and the thing is the way penalty decisions are going, you almost have to fall on the floor for a penalty decision to be given. Raheem Sterling, again, there's so many examples where he's sort of been tripped as he's on his way in the box, and he sort of looks like he starts skating in a cartoon manner to keep his feet, and he can't keep up, and then he ends up skewing a shot wide, and then it just looks like, oh, classic Raheem Sterling, can't finish. But really, he's tried so hard to stay on his feet, couldn't get the shot away. In my opinion, that should then be a penalty, because there's no advantage. He would have ran into the box, been on balance, and got a shot away, but... because of the need to be on the floor for it to be deemed a foul, you've now got this thing where players feel like they have to go down if they do get a small bit of contact. And then obviously, if you're getting a small bit of contact and you're going to the floor, you're going to exaggerate it. So, as I said, calling this certain incident a dive, I know there was controversy on Match of the Day with Phil Neville saying you should be allowed to do it, and then Shearer saying he should definitely be punished. It's obviously going to divide opinion, and I think... they've tried to introduce these laws, and this is the first Premier League case where someone's been penalised, that we almost forgot about it as well. Bernardo Silva's been looked at this season, and Richarlison as well, with that penalty Arsenal. That was looked at, but we forgot that there was this panel because there wasn't punishment. So the fact that this has come back in, I think, as you said, opening up a can of worms now. Now, every time someone dies, people will now remember there are these
just
rules.
Every soft penalty. Yeah, not when someone exactly. dies. Every soft penalty, that'd be like demands.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. It's now people, we can get people banned for this now, or we can appeal for this. Like, Everton have contested this ban themselves. But the fact now that there's visible proof that someone can be banned for two games, it's just going to a new dialogue's going to open up, and it's, I think it's going to start to be tedious with every penalty decision. Why isn't that being looked at by the retrospective action panel?
I think there's some weight to the argument that diving is a skill as well.
Ugh.
I do. I honestly do. I just think that in all sports this happens. You mean, if you bend the rules and you can get away with it, then and to get your team marginal gains, then fair enough.
Yeah. It's all well and good because I'm, you know, I'll stand there like, he's a diver. Send him off, ban him forever. But then I think it might have been the England games. Maybe it was, it might have been Harry Kane, possibly. Like, went in the box and someone basically collided with him and he stayed up and then absolutely nothing came of the attack.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh, too honest. Yeah, too honest. Go down.
That's the exact point. In an ideal world, I think when there's unfair contact, no matter where you end up and what angle your legs are pointing towards, a foul is a foul. You shouldn't have to be on the floor for it to be a foul. And I think we ended up creating our own problems for this because the players, as George said, not a skill, but the awareness to think, right, I've just been clipped. I know that's a foul. I know that that has affected my balance and my ability to kick the ball or do my next action on the ball. They've realised that if I go on the floor, then I'll definitely get it. Whereas some people are naive or probably too honest, as you said. They think, oh, that's hurt me, but I can still get the ball. I'll try, and then they'll bring it back. Whenever do you see like a real... Unless it's in the middle of the pitch and it's like a shirt pulled back and the players just stop, nothing really gets given now unless someone ends up on the floor. And I think that in itself is really wrong. And this panel, again, now people will be aware of it. Maybe
these nobodies, yeah. These schmucks on the panel, yeah. Never played the game, not even at five-a-side level.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. I think the ban will get upheld because they can't be looked to going back on it already, even though it was soft. But now it's just going to be a case of every decision. I don't think it's going to have the desired impact. As I said, ideal world, contact is judged as contact and you see how it affects the player. But now it's just who can flop the most.
Do you blame Umanias? I blame Umanias.
I don't blame Umanias.
You
no,
don't?
No.
You're not one of,
sorry
not one
for Umanias. Umanias has had a torrid couple of years and, you know, he's doing his best to come back from the brink every time and then he gets slapped with the historic too much ban.
Poor bloke. Ex-match officials, ex-managers and ex-players are against him.
Ex-players?
Yeah, there is one ex-player.
They're not schmucks after all.
Yeah.
Well, they might be a really schmucky ex-player.
Yeah, there you go. And there probably is.
Yeah, like Tim Breaker. I'm going to sound like Ronald Koeman when Umanias turned up to training. And that's the next section. Who's this fella?
Who's this fella?
Who is Sven Mislintat? Seriously, because he's in the news.
I reckon Jake will have a encyclopedic knowledge of him from the last 24 hours, is my guess.
On the way to Arsenal, Sven Mislintat. Also known as, and it's written down here, Diamond Eye.
Yeah.
Diamond Eye, show me sweet Diamond Eye. That's the new chant for Sven Mislintat, who's not going to be on the pitch at any point.
I was going to say, he's not even a player. But it's really interesting, as you said, he's been, for someone that's now becoming a head of recruitment at a club, he's got a lot of screen time, if you will. There's been quite a lot of hype around him.
It's like when you nearly got that Ralph Rangnick bloke.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. Oh, no, was it you? Was it Arsenal that nearly got him? Was it England? It was England, wasn't it? It was like, well, he's going to bring all these youth players through. Like, yeah.
In fairness, he's literally like, he has masterminded like the you know, the growth of Leipzig. So he's done all right.
Yeah, I mean, but Ralph. What have they ever done other than beat Monaco? Honestly, they did do it, right? I didn't get that one. That one's correct. Jake, I can see you're itching to wax lyrical about Mislintat.
Well, so Diamond Eye, as you said, he is called.
sounds like a sort of Wild West fantasy character.
Bond villain. It's Jake's nickname for him. He's trying to get going on this podcast. No one's ever called him that before.
Yeah. I'm trying to get on his side.
Trust me, Dad. He's got like Diamond Eyes.
Well, the reason he's called that is because he's meant to be this scouting guru that's been working at Borussia Dortmund. And he was happy to be at Borussia Dortmund, but had a bit of a falling out with Thomas Tuchel, the previous manager, which is bizarre that this then dictated his decision because obviously Thomas Tuchel isn't now there. But last season there was sour grapes with Thomas Tuchel. He got sort of banned from the training ground and interacting with players. So started looking at his options. Bayern Munich tried to sign him in the summer and been interested before, but now Arsenal have got rid of their head of recruitment, Steve Rowley, who was in charge for 25 years. So he's brought through a lot of players and as well a lot of bad players have been under his tenure. But it sort of is the reason it's got a lot of press and I think a lot of interest is because it's the first changing of the guard in the Arsenal backroom staff. It's even Gazidis came out when Arsene Wenger signed his new contract that yes, Arsene Wenger's staying on, but there will be change, and this is a sign of that change. They've brought in someone from Borussia Dortmund who at 45 years old, that's not that old at all really for what he's supposed to be doing. And the reason there is excitement is because at Borussia Dortmund, he found the likes of Shinji Kagawa, Ousmane Dembele and Robert Lewandowski. So there's that real looking forward now that he'll help Arsenal rediscover that sort of form of finding these great youngsters and then transferring it into a good team. I don't think they'll want to be following the Borussia Dortmund model exactly where they sell these players. They bought Shinji Kagawa for £350,000. And then he ended up going to Man United and is now the all-time leading Japanese goalscorer in the Bundesliga. So he turned out all right. We know Robert Lewandowski's good and Ousmane Dembele then went for £100 million profit. So he's got a good track record. He's got a brilliant nickname and it's a sign of the change at Arsenal that fans have been looking for. And to get him in before January as well is really interesting to see if there are already some moves that are made in the winter window.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say Steve Rowley, who's no longer in charge, because you got to ask the question about whether or not he was ever really in charge.
Yeah. And I think that's a very good point.
And I think that this is a poignant thing about this move, is that it may signal the end of Wenger's at least monopoly over everything Arsenal. It's been a friendly dictatorship under Wenger, and it looks like he's now opening the door to the other people into positions of power, which I think is significant. I also think it's significant when he's left Dortmund because they have gone on a huge recruitment spree in the last 12 months of basically cherry-picking European talent. And if that goes well in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, then this bloke's stock is going to be, you know, it's high now. He's going to be basically the world leader. The likes of Isaac and, you know, you mentioned Dembele, who's always been sold on. There was this huge, you know, you could basically make a team of their young recruits. Mm. So
Jadon Sancho.
I was about to say.
Jadon Sancho, exactly. I mean, and these are guys who probably aren't quite first team ready yet, but are going to be making that transition in the next 3 or 4 years. And he has, I'm sure this guy was at the forefront of that. And so for him to jump ship before this new generation of talent and comes through can only be exciting for Arsenal fans, because he obviously sees this as a huge... And it was interesting, I read in the Dortmund press release, the club said, you know, we couldn't stand in Sven's way for this amazing opportunity at Arsenal. So, I mean, they obviously see it as being an amazing opportunity. Yeah, well, I mean, how much freedom is he going to be given at Arsenal? If he's literally given a checkbook and told that he's going to be able to go and sign, then, you know, this could be huge news.
That's what I was going to say as well. It's their press release was quite interesting because they said this really... They cited it as a lucrative or huge offer from Arsenal. So they were sort of saying, like, we've done well out of this. So I think it's almost like a signing. Mm. Arsenal have had to pay a bit of money, and I can imagine his contract's very good.
Well, maybe they feel as well, like, he's been there for so long that he's probably got people there that know his techniques and they know where he's getting it from.
Maybe they know that he hasn't done any of them.
Yeah. They've said, we've stolen all your secrets, Diamond Eye, and now it's our time to reap rewards. It is like a Bond script.
You've got the whole story behind you.
Yeah.
You've been thinking about it.
I smell some fan fiction here already.
Jake's just there drawing pictures of a topless Diamond Eye.
Topless, where? With or without Arsene?
Yeah, both of them. Yeah. Two topless Wenger and Diamond Eye, topless.
Got it, yeah.
And Jake's little note.
Never type Xabi Alonso, Steven Gerrard fan fiction into Google, that's what I'll say.
Well, wow. That's what I'm going to do right now while the listeners listen to the jingle for the Stats Showdown.
Stats Showdown.
So here we are. The most intense moment of Jake's week. And for George, it's just another moment in what has been an otherwise intense week.
Yeah.
The Stats Showdown. Best out of three for some quick, snappy, sometimes wacky stats that the layman can use down the pub to impress his mates quickly and not some meandering essay about expected goals. Jake, I'm looking at you. Or take-ons. I'm still looking at you, Jake.
I've got no take-ons.
No take-ons, but it sounds like he might have expected goals.
Sounds like you're on the pitch.
Oh, that's harsh.
Jake, you're itching to have the first of your stats shots. in George's direction. So go on, take him down.
So I'm gonna go back to Mo Salah for this, and I thought this was ridiculous, really. And again, it's quite simple. It's not expected goals, it's just about goals. So Liverpool take on Chelsea at the weekend. Salah going against his former club, time to prove his worth fully. If he scores, he'll become the first Liverpool player to score 15 goals in a season since Luis Suarez in 2013-14. And it's only November. Shows how poor they've been and how...
They have been poor.
Salah has been.
Go on, George. Wow me.
Right, I'm going to the wowing Brighton for my stat. So Brighton have had the fewest shots inside the area of any team in the Premier League with just 41, yet had the joint most shots in the 6-yard box with 17.
It's wacky. It is wacky.
It's so weird.
playing their way into the 6-yard box.
I like it, George. George has gone 1-0 up. I'm sorry, but telling me that Liverpool haven't been very good for the last 3 years.
It's fine. I started off with my weakest one.
That is unbelievable, that, though. How does that happen?
Wild.
Yeah.
Brighton, defying expectation, defying belief.
That was just Glenn Murray, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's... Was
the
it Brighton?
GM, the general manager.
Pascal Gross whipping it in, right on a sixpence.
Yeah.
Glenn Murray getting his head on it.
Yeah, good for Glenn, that's what I say.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, George, double up.
So you've gone from the glamorous Brighton to the even more glamorous Ashley Barnes.
Oh, he is glamorous.
So out of players who've played 10 or more games, Ashley Barnes has fouled every 33.6 minutes, which is a sixth in the Premier League, and commits a foul every 28.8 minutes, which is top of the Premier League, which means that on average, he is engaged in 5.8 basically fringements.
Per game.
5.8.
Oh, headless chicken tearing about.
It is impressive, and that's coming from someone who watched Andy Carroll foul someone within 6 seconds.
Yeah.
Jake, come on. Is yours as aggressive?
It's not as aggressive, but I'm going to have to... I think that one is good, so I'm going to have to get out my kicker, I think. Again, this... I didn't want to do two in a row with the Liverpool-Chelsea game, but I'm going to have to now. Liverpool, the only English club Antonio Conte has faced in his managerial career and not beaten. He's even beaten Chelsea.
When did he beat Chelsea?
Juventus. So he's played 25 English teams in his career, and Liverpool, the only one he's never won against.
That is good. That's a real pub fact. That's a pub fact point to that one. Jake, you've equalised. You've pulled it back. Now you've got the chance to get the upper hand.
Now I've got the chance. And this is, again, one that I find really interesting. But again...
Oh, sounds like you've won this week, George.
So Leroy Sané this season has been one of the best players. And he scored and assisted in the same game on 4 occasions already in 12 games. If he does that again against Huddersfield at the weekend, which is likely, he would have equaled already the most that someone managed last season. So he would have scored and assisted in 5 games, and only one player did that in 38 games last season, which was Romelu Lukaku. Extra info.
Okay, bit long-winded.
yeah,
it's hard.
Mine's quite simple.
It looks nicer when you see it in front of you.
Mine's looking at two of England's youngest talents
and their
creative ability. It's very simple, this.
Oh.
Jordan Pickford, with 3, has played more key passes than Tom Davis this season. So who's played 2?
No way. How many is Tom Davis playing every week as
He's
well?
He's played 600 minutes, I think, yeah.
Ah.
There you go. That's Pickford's kicking that I've mentioned.
Yeah, I know.
He's come back to kick me in the butt.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, there he is. Jake's coming in with the stand-up routine. Yeah. He's already done his downward eye bit. Yeah. Now he's got his Jordan Pickford kicking bit.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Jake, you're a loser. George, that one's a bit of me. That
I hope Jordan Pickford doesn't hear that, because that's going to only encourage him to keep doing these ridiculous kicks.
No, they're not ridiculous. They're brilliant.
I mean, he's obviously amazingly talented at doing it, but I mean, Christ, it's a bit of a procession, isn't it? The way he does it, like he's putting on a show. They say that saves are for the cameras. His kicking's for the cameras.
Oh yeah, but if I could kick the ball like that, I'd be just kicking everything. I'd be like, do you need a pen? Seeing it off, kicking it across the room.
Yeah, can you walk 100 yards away? Yeah, please? Yeah. Thank you. Right.
Cheers, mate.
Where can people find you? The winner of this week's Stat Showdown. Sorry, Jake.
Just, on Twitter, on @GeorgeElek, ELEK.
And Jake, as for you?
They can find me, the loser, on Twitter as well, @JakeEntwistle, as usual, ENTWI.
It's soon to just be at Diamond Dye with a patch, with a picture of Sven, isn't it?
At Pickford Kick.
Diamond Dyeology.
Pickford-esque. Pickford-esque kicking-ology.
Yeah. There's no H's, but there's lots of naked drawings of Diamond Dye. And you can find me at @RobArmstrong_WH on Twitter. And, of course, you can find this very podcast on Deezer, on iTunes, and everywhere where you get your podcasts. Do that usual stuff that all the young kids say. Share, rate, review, subscribe. George Ellick's doing all of them off a different account now because he loves it so much. And yeah, and that's about it. Jake, how many drawings of Arsene Wenger and Diamond Eye are you going to do?
I'm midway through. I think that's why I lost the stat showdown. I was already getting my next one in, my next piece.
I'm sure this one's going to be your magnum opus. I can't wait to see it next week on Defending in Numbers.
Defending in Numbers is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.